From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, criminologist David M. Kennedy joins us in studio for the hour. He's internationally recognized for the work he has done in reducing urban violence and is the author of the recently released Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and The End of Violence in Inner City America. He joins us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. David M. Kennedy joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control and professor of criminal justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's also co-chair of the National Network for Safe Communities, and his strategies for reducing urban crime have been implemented in over 70 cities, including San Francisco. He's received numerous awards for his work and is author of a new book called Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and The End of Violence in America, which Malcolm Gladwell says, quote, will do for the fight against violence what Rachel Carson's Silent Spring did for the environmental movement a generation ago. David M. Kennedy joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thanks, Michael.
High praise for Malcolm and much praise that you've received and many awards for the work. So let's find out about the work itself, because it's hard work as opposed to being described as a Boston miracle. I know you've taken a little exception to that idea that there's something miraculous about all this hard work you did. It goes back to, well, the crack epidemic in 1990. And I suppose it would be quite useful for listeners to hear what this giant intervention amounts to, how it was done.
So I'll tell the story. It doesn't actually take very long. And everybody's reaction to the simple description of what it is you've got to be kidding. And then the rest of it is understanding why this actually works, which it really does. But actually describing it doesn't take that long. So in any city, the homicide and the shooting and a lot of the chaos associated with street drug stuff and that kind of thing comes back to gangs and drug crews and other groups of very high rate prominent offenders. And the degree to which that's true is shocking. So we're working in Cincinnati right now. And in Cincinnati, 61 of these gangs and groups and crews with 1,500 people in them, which is less than 0.5% of the city's population, generate 70% of all the homicides in Cincinnati. That's the way it works in any city. That's the pattern.
That disproportionately high number.
Fantastically concentrated problem. And that's not evenly distributed across a city, right? This stuff is concentrated in poor minority and especially poor distressed black communities. So in those places, 1 in 200 young black men can be murdered every year. I mean, it's appalling what's going on. But what the concentration means is that if you influence the behavior of those gangs and groups and drug crews, you have a massively disproportionate impact on the killing and the violence. So that's what we have learned how to do. And the intervention is you tell them to stop. Then this is where everybody starts laughing and rolling their eyes. But honestly, that's what you do. You can identify the groups. They stand out. They're not working undercover. It's very obvious who's doing what. When you look at the groups and the people in them, the individuals are such fantastically high-rate offenders that just as a matter of fact, every group's going to have somebody on probation or parole at any given time, often several people. That means probation and parole can order them to come to a room, tell them to come to a meeting, and when they walk into the meeting, they find a room full of law enforcement, social service providers, and community people. And that partnership, and a lot of the work in this is putting that partnership together and keeping it going, but that partnership looks at them and says some very simple stuff. It says, you are here because you're a member of a group. This is nothing personal. It's not a sting. You're going to go back home in an hour, so just relax, and we've got some things we want to tell you. Take what you hear back to your group. You are a messenger back to your group on the streets. They all need to hear what you're about to hear. And it turns out they do take the messages back. And everybody says, we care about you. You are important to us. We want you to live. We don't want to lock you up. Even the cops would rather not have to lock you up. You are doing a couple of things that have to stop. This is a conversation about violence. We're not talking about everything you may be doing. We're not talking about your being in a gang. We are talking about the killing and the shooting and the terror, and the community needs that to stop. This is not okay. The community folks are the best at conveying that. And I have seen rooms full of the most dangerous people in a city hear a mother tell the story of what it meant to her and her family and the surviving brothers and sisters to have their gangbanger son murdered, and see all these extraordinarily dangerous, tough guys sitting there with tears streaming down their faces. There are people they will listen to. So the community says, you are hurting us. You are hurting yourselves. We can't have this. It has to stop. The social service providers say, we would really like to help you. Anybody who wants to get out of this, we will do anything we possibly can for you.
Get out of this meaning a life of violence, not necessarily getting out of the gang.
Whatever they want. If they just want to stop shooting, that's a good start. If they'd like to leave the streets entirely, that's even better. But we will help you in any way that we can. And we've put together a special kind of social service structure for you and everybody in your crew. Here is the phone number to call. If you and they call this number, we will turn ourselves inside out to help you. And we have stories of guys leaving the meeting, going back to the streets, calling on their cell phone. And when they're done passing their cell phone around to all 13 guys in their crew, and they all sign up too. Doesn't always happen, but it does happen. And the cops say, we want you to listen to them. Whatever you think of us, we do not get up in the morning to lock you up. We will do it if we have to. We've been doing it for a long time. It hasn't been working. It hasn't stopped the shooting. We know that as well as you do. We're doing something different. And the first thing we're doing is standing with your community and these folks who'd like to help you. And we do stand with them. We want you to succeed. We want you to live. We don't want you in prison, but we're not asking. This is not a negotiation.
These are cops whom they traditionally distrust deeply, though, right?
Both sides distrust each other. The streets don't trust the cops. The community doesn't trust the cops. The cops don't trust the street guys. They think
they're
sociopaths.
So the cops are giving them a kind of rhetoric that maybe they are not necessarily used to hearing, but at the same time, maybe not necessarily all that open to hearing either.
Yeah, they're not only used to it, they're shocked by it. Right? The streets genuinely think the cops hate them personally, and they don't. That's not what's going on. But we'll get to this. There's a lot of misunderstanding here, and that's one of the most important things. But the cops say, we respect you enough to tell you how we're going to be doing business from now on. And here it is. When you leave this room and go back to your sets on the streets, tell them two things on our behalf, please. The first thing is, we will, after this meeting, systematically go after the most violent gang in the city. So whichever one is doing the most shooting and killing and creating the most chaos, everybody here, state, local, federal, cops, prosecutors, U.S. attorney, DEA, FBI, ATF, ICE, IRS, probation, parole, everybody is going to get together and focus on that group. And when that happens, they're going to lose. Because when we focus that hard and that consciously, we can figure out how to take that group down.
That might be a challenge to some of these gang members, I would think, if they've got a lot of firepower and they think the police are after them and they hate the police. Mm-hmm.
So that's a perfectly reasonable and wrong conclusion. This isn't a war we're fighting. You know, it's not a battle. It's just chaos. And people say about these guys all the time, you know, they don't care what happened to them. They don't care if they live or die. They'll tell that to your face. Our mistake is that we believe that. And the fact is, they don't touch hot stoves. They look both ways before they cross the street. When the cops try to catch them, they run. When they get caught, they hire defense attorneys. They don't want to get killed. They don't want to go to prison. And they're not locked in a pitched battle with law enforcement. So what actually happens when you tell them that clearly how you're going to do your job, they get out of the way. So we're going to go do the most violent group. But we're also going to do something really new and different. And that is that the second thing we're going to do when this meeting is over is wait for the first body to hit the ground. And whatever gang or crew or set has done that, we're going to follow that body to the group and we're going to focus all of our attention on that group. And we'll get the shooter for the shooting. But it is the nature of these gangs that nearly everybody in them is committing crimes all the time, which means that this law enforcement team can address their drug sales, their drug use, their outstanding warrants, their probation and parole violations, their open cases, their, you know, endless laundry list of crimes that they're committing, which means that the price the group will pay for this homicide, for example, is that everybody gets picked up on street drug charges. And when the streets understand that that's what's going to happen, when they understand that their community wants them to stop, when there is a way out, and when they can hide behind this new sheriff in town thing. So a lot of what happens is these guys are scared. They're miserable. They're not getting rich. They're getting killed. They're getting locked up. They are not having a good time. And the mistake we make is thinking that they will fight us. They don't like this. They just don't really know what else to do. And this
new, and a lot of it's peer anyway, isn't it?
A huge amount of it is peer pressure. You get one of these guys alone, and he says, I'm scared. I hate it. All my friends are locked up. Half my friends have been killed. Everybody's been shot. I'm worried about my mom. I'm worried about my little brother. And then he goes back with his friends, and he starts fronting like a gang member. And they keep each other going, and they egg each other on, and they enforce on each other this toxic street code about respect and disrespect and all this stuff. But as individuals, they nearly none of them really like what's going on. So they use this new sheriff in town thing as an excuse to back off. They say to each other, I'd really like to go do that drive-by, but look at what happened to the last guys that did that. They're all locked up. They're going to come do the same thing to us. I don't think we'd better do that. And it's what we've come to understand as an honorable exit. They don't have to say, we've reconsidered our lifestyle and I don't think it's serving us very well and these respect norms that we're living our lives by are toxic. They just say, they're going to lock us all up. Don't do it.
Many of them need jobs too, though. I mean, most of them do, don't they? I mean, and want to have jobs.
That's not as simple as we think it is. And the most important way it's not as simple as we think it is that, and we've learned this over time too, the opposite of killing somebody is not working. The opposite of killing somebody is not killing somebody. And most people on the street will never kill anybody. Most people in a drug crew will never kill anybody. Most people in a gang will never kill anybody. Most gangs in a lot of cities will never kill anybody. And it is not the money or the lack of money that drives the killing. Almost all the violence is about street code stuff. It's not about protecting your corner or your market or a ripoff or an unpaid debt. It's got nothing to do with money. It is overwhelmingly this street honor code thing. It's about if I'm disrespected, I have to hurt you or I am nothing. It's the enemy of my friend is my enemy, and you've got a beef with my boy, so I've got a beef with all your boys.
Or it's even what color you wear. I mean, I remember a program we did a few years ago with when the Crips and Bloods had made a kind of peace pact,
right.
And we had them both here talking about how just colors, you know, we get them enraged when they'd see a color that was outside of their hood and all that sort of
right.
thing. We're talking, by the way, with David Kennedy, and his new book is Don't Shoot, One Man, Street Fellowship and the End of Violence in Inner City America. End of Violence in inner city America sounds like a pretty high bar, I suppose, to most people. But you're looking at this as a real plausible goal.
It's not plausible. It's proved. Right? This is what people don't understand. There's a 15-year record more than that now, going back to the first time this was done in Boston in the mid-1990s.
You cut two-thirds, though, you didn't, right, as far as the violence went, and cut down the drug trade enormously.
Cut down two-thirds citywide. And what that meant was that in many of what were the previously hottest neighborhoods, it stopped almost completely. So in Sacramento, there's a team working out of the Public Health Institute here in Oakland that's supporting this tiny little team, three people. And they're working with 10 cities, helping them do this across California. One of them is Sacramento. And in the most dangerous neighborhood in Sacramento, over a year ago, they began this work. And since they began it, there has been one non-fatal shooting.
That's very impressive. And you were here in San Francisco during Willie Brown's administration.
Yeah.
That program is no longer in operation. Why?
Well, the simple answer is Fajita Gate. So I was sitting in my office in Cambridge one day and went on SF Gate and looked at it, and my entire project had been indicted.
Well, that brings up another interesting point, though. I'm reading actually from a piece that Alex Kotlowitz did, and he says, Kennedy's approach, despite his protestations to the contrary, seems like friendlier yet stricter policing. Toward the end of his book, he writes, quote, people will accept a result they don't like as long as they feel that they've been treated with fairness and decency. Agreed. Although he brings social workers and ex-cons to the sit-downs with gang members, the police are running the show, and I worry that his program amounts to a further crackdown on those whom Kennedy, despite his sensitivities, occasionally refers to as thugs. If we call people something long enough, they'll embody it.
So this is an interesting idea, that the reason in many, many, many of our communities, people are running around shooting and killing and dealing drugs is because people like me call them a name.
Well, he's also saying the police are running the show, though, and I think that's kind of the criticism, maybe even more than the word thug. Do the police really run the show here?
In a way, they do.
And I thought of that when you mentioned Fajita Gate, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. So the fact is, and Alex doesn't like this, but it's true, that there is nothing in this area that has worked without the core involvement of law enforcement. Lots of people don't like that. I wish it were otherwise myself, but the empirical fact is that that's the truth. So lots and lots of people have tried in lots of different ways to work in the community, to do social work programs, to mobilize ex-offenders, to do all kinds of work on their own. And the track record on this stuff is simply not arguable. It doesn't work.
There's a lot of hopeful stories here, aren't there?
Yeah. Really? But part of what's hopeful is that, so Alex is right, the police are central, if not running the show. And it's a different kind of police. That's the big point, that when you get a law enforcement agency into this work, they go in thinking the following things. They think the guys on the street are sociopaths. They think they're crazy. They think they really don't care whether they live or die or go to prison. They think the community is completely corrupt. They think the only reason this is going on is because everybody's living off drug money and all the mothers are on the pipe and the community's quiet because it doesn't care about the violence.
And forgive me, but they're also very menaced, these police officers. They're under a feeling of imminent violence, or the potential violence puts them in a high anxiety state.
It's really not that that makes them anxious. It's that everybody hates them. And that's a terrible place to live. And then there are these perfectly symmetrical mirror images. So the guys on the street think the cops hate them personally and that that's racist. The community thinks at the very best that law enforcement doesn't care about it because nothing law enforcement's doing is helping. And a lot of people in the community think that the cops and the rest of us are mounting a deliberate racist conspiracy to do them damage.
Yeah. I was going to ask, how do they respond to you? I mean, you're a white guy. You've got long hair. And people can't see you because you're on the radio. You've got a beard. You have kind of what we used to call a hippie look, really.
Yeah. I don't know what they think. It doesn't usually last beyond the first 15 minutes, though, because what they hear me say is not what they expect. And then we're into a different place. But there are these toxic understandings between all the key parties here. And what Alex and a lot of other people miss is that as you go through the actual work itself, everybody sees unexpected things and they start to change what they think. So the guys on the street see the cops saying to them, "I don't want to lock you up. I am standing here with you so that I don't have to lock you up," which means, in fact, a lot less people get locked up. The cops see the community saying to these guys, "Of course I love you and I want you to live, but do I like what you're doing? I hate what you're doing. You are tearing the guts out of this community and we need it to stop." And what the cops think of the community starts to change. Everything shifts. And what you see in the police departments and prosecutors' offices that are committed to this work is that they're not locking everybody up. They are focusing on the right people. You know, go back to where we started. Almost nobody in these neighborhoods is doing this stuff. The cops are acting in most places right now like everybody's guilty. They're stopping everybody. They're treating everybody the same way. This helps them understand that 95% of the people in the most troubled community are not part of this. They're not even looking to arrest the 5%. They're looking to get their attention. They're trying to get them help. If that's not working, they're trying to deter them, which isn't about arresting them. And only at the end of all that do you go to the old stuff.
Talking again with David Kennedy, his new book, Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. I'm going to open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us in conversation. If you have questions or comments for our guest, David Kennedy, we welcome your involvement in the program. It's toll-free whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786. Again, we'd like to hear from you, and we certainly welcome your phone calls. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Email address is forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And, of course, you can also contribute to the conversation by going to Facebook and letting us know what you think. And we welcome your calls and your involvement in the program. We're just about ready for a break here, and when we come back, we'll hear from our listeners. I'm just wondering about the sense of how this is different now as opposed to the crack cocaine period, because that was really when you began the operation and when you really started seeing results.
Yeah. Well, the work's evolved, so it's much more community focused right now. We're much more focused on this deeply toxic, racialized animosity between law enforcement and the communities, which can really be undone in remarkably short order. The street scene hasn't changed very much. You know, people think crack's over. Crack's not over. And we've got these drug markets and these gang dynamics still in most of our cities, and they're moving out into smaller communities, the cities all over the country that never thought they'd be dealing with this.
Even little rural towns, yeah. In fact. You were sort of an inspiration for the Interrupters, too, at least so I've read. Yeah.
Not entirely. We can talk about that if you want.
Well, what we're going to do is hear from our listeners, too. And again, David Kennedy, our guest. Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence. He'll be at Stanford Law School 5:30 to 7 tonight, reading and discussing with East Palo Alto Chief of Police Ronald Davis. And he's also the author of Reconsidering Deterrence and Beyond 911, A New Era for Policing, with Malcolm K. Sparrow and Mark H. Moore. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is David M. Kennedy. He's director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control, also a professor of criminal justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, and has a new book out called Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. Again, your involvement in the program is welcome. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, communicate with us on our Facebook page. Let's go right to your calls. And Michael is first up from San Jose. Michael, hi. You're on.
Hey. Mike from San Jose.
Yes.
Thanks for your program, which is the one that I listen to on the radio, by the way. Mr. Kennedy, what do you think, what lessons do you think policymakers could take from your work, which I think it's obvious, but it was not so simple. what lessons can they take to apply to conflicts such as like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
So that's a really interesting question, and not one I'm personally competent to talk about very much. What I can say is that there are folks who really do know about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and think about counterinsurgency and who have the same understanding of jihadism and that kind of thing that I have of street gangs, who actually think that there's some lessons to be learned here, and that if you really understand what's going on with jihadis, for example, it's not the monolithic, top-down, religious war that we think it is. It's groups of young men egging each other on and afraid and not willing to say so and doing stupid things because their friends are watching. And that actually talking about what Islam, for example, really means, and that it does not mean jihad in the way that they're being taught, actually changes their behavior. And apparently there's evidence of that.
And let me thank the caller. On we go to another caller. This is from Santa Rosa. Donna, hi. Join us.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having my call. Mr. Kennedy, thank you so much for the work you're doing. It's so important, and it's so wonderful to have a sane conversation with all these parties. I just wanted to call and thank you for that. But also, my husband is an educator and works with at-risk youth in the high school. And the last high school he was a principal at, to a student, every single one of them was involved in the gang, in various gangs. He had four gang factions in his school. Mm-hmm. And many of them were actually children of gang members that grew up and were now in the gang. And I just see so many similarities to his work and your work. And I'm wondering, do you reach out to high school students as well? And are you working in the schools?
We do, because there's no moat between the community and schools, as you know very well. And usually when we talk about school violence, for example, it is not really school violence. It's the kind of community violence we're talking about playing itself out in schools. There's nothing specially schoolish about it, which turns out to mean that if you do the kind of work that we're talking about and have this big community impact, you get big changes in these tensions that often play out in schools. We've also got some of our partners that are looking at deliberately mapping this way of thinking about things into schools. And one of my partners has done the same kind of call-in intervention. There was a troubled school. It turns out same pattern always applies. It's a very small number of identifiable students driving things. And they had a call-in with them and with their parents. And evidently, as I understand it, things have really improved.
Let me thank the caller. We have an iconic figure here in the Bay Area named Joe Marshall, who works with youth over in the Bayview Hunters Point. He's an African-American and, in fact, a MacArthur Genius recipient, and has done some remarkable work with gang members. And what one learns from Joe's work is that so many of these young people, we were talking about peer pressure before, so many of these young people need, well, a father figure or mm-hmm. a mother figure, or, you know, a strong person who can lead them and who can be that kind of influence that Joe Marshall has been on so many youths. Where does that come into your whole program, or does it?
It absolutely does. And so this is really what we've come to call the moral voice of the community. So when people think about this, and often when they look at our work, they say, oh, that's carrot and it's stick. It's the cops. It's law enforcement. And it misses the point. I mean, and it's wrong. There's a third thing, which actually trumps everything else, and that is what we call the moral voice of the community. People think these guys are sociopaths, just to say it again. They're not, and they are people.
A few of them might be. I think we would concede.
You know, honestly, I've been doing this for 20 years, and in all that time, I think I've probably met two real sociopaths, and they are scary. I mean, they make me want to go hide in the basement. But that's not what's going on out there. It really isn't. And there are people they will listen to. There are people they respect. Those people are in the communities. People think these communities are rudderless and they are chaotic and they're damaged. But every single one of them has very, very, very strong figures. And part of what you can do as a real matter of work is find those people, support them, elevate them, and bring them into new relationships with the very few people that are driving these issues. And it makes an enormous difference.
You were going to tell us a story about this toxic code of honor, and I'd like to hear that.
So it really is the street code that drives an enormous amount of this. It's not about money. It is about respect and disrespect and what the streets think you need to do when you're disrespected and what it means to be a man. And we are sucked into these days this framework, this picture, this set of images around these communities and black and minority and drugs and gangs and all that kind of thing. And it makes us kind of crazy, frankly. So not that long ago in the United States, young men of privilege and breeding and white went into the woods at dawn by prior arrangement and hacked at each other with big knives. Now, that's what dueling was. That was that code in the antebellum South. And they didn't do it because they came from single mother families. They didn't do it because they lived in blighted communities. They didn't do it because they were crack dealers. They did it because the code that they lived by said, if you don't do that, you're nothing. And because their friends were watching. And I've remembered on this tour something I used to say, and I'll use it again. There is no stupider organism on the planet than a young man with his friends watching. And that is not about this problem or this moment in history or these communities. This is just the way honor codes function, and there's no shortage of honor codes.
The Gahanian author, whose name is not coming immediately to my mind, who's a Princeton professor, talked about how dueling just stopped and goes into that whole analysis, like foot binding and how these things just...
Norms change, thank God.
As a listener, Franklin Zimmering, who has been on this program many times, is a UC Berkeley law professor and is often quoted in particularly things having to do with criminology, your field. He says that anti-violence ceasefire programs lack adequate analysis. And I'm reading here from something posted in The New Yorker. Ceasefire is more a theory of treatment than a proven strategy, he said. It's odd that no one has ever said, okay, here are the youths who are not part of the ceasefire program in Boston. Let's compare them to the youths who were. And no one has followed up with any long-range studies of the criminal behavior of the group that was in the program either. We just don't have the evidence. And until we do, we can't evaluate how effective ceasefire really is.
Right. Frank is unfortunately in error on these points. So two things, and I'll say the most important one first, and then I'll get to the other one. So Frank was, when he said that, was looking at this as if it were a traditional social service program, which in the traditional way we do this work, we sit a kid down, we intervene with him in some way, either he does better or he doesn't. We can compare him to the kids we didn't do that with, and that's the way we think about this. And it's natural to think about this that way because that's what it looks like. You sit a room full of guys down, you tell them to behave. We ought to be able to do those kinds of comparisons. But that's not the way this work works. So when you have a room full of 40 gang members and you talk to them, you're not, in our work, dealing with those 40 guys. You're dealing with the 40 crews that they belong to out on the street. And if it works, and this stuff does work, the behavior of everybody in all those 40 crews changes. It's not about the guys in the room. You're not treating them. You're treating the gang dynamic in the city. And either you succeed in that or you don't. But if you succeed in it, you touch everybody, not just the people who Frank thinks is in the program. So that's the big
point. It's kind of a meme more than a social service type thing.
Yeah, exactly right.
Let's go to more calls, and we'll take a caller. Al, join us. You're on.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to ask your screener, what planet is he from? I mean, everybody...
Wait a minute, he's not a screener. I don't know.
Squads are there for the purpose to murder, maim, and generally terrorize innocent black guys. And I don't have to mention the case of the attempted murder of Rodney King, the murder of Oscar Grant, Gary King, you know. So, I mean, what planet is this guy from?
I'm from Brooklyn.
Yeah, but he's saying the police are known, from his perspective, to be lethal when it comes to gang members and people on the street and whatnot.
You know, I honestly wish that he were right, because if it were that simple, it would be a lot easier to deal with. Black Americans are a seventh of the population. They are half of the nation's homicide dead, and they're not getting killed by cops. They're getting killed by each other.
Some emails. Let's go to some of these. Here's Steve, who says, hello, David Kennedy is a hero. Thanks for having him on. I reviewed his book in today's San Francisco Chronicle. The author reinforces your guest point that gangs are confirmed and confirmed repeat offenders are disproportionately responsible for violence and death, but also that our mainstream cultural obsession with guns and widespread paranoia about crime, even as crime rates drop, and the NRA's extreme positions make solutions unlikely. Does Kennedy have any comments re-gun control as part of the solution?
Oh, yeah. So my work in this actually began on the gun side. The book traces this, but what became Operation Ceasefire in Boston didn't start out that way. It started out with my thinking that one way of intervening in the killing was to intervene in the illicit gun markets through which these kids were getting guns. And we actually made a lot of headway on that. It wasn't what turned out to be the most important thing on the ground, but in parallel with these gang interventions, we did a huge amount of work unpacking and then figuring out how to address these illicit gun markets. The Clinton administration picked that up. We helped them design something called the Youth Crime Gun Interdiction Initiative, which took this anti-illicit trafficking gun market work to about 60 cities across the country.
Is that when the buyback occurred?
No, those are different. Now, buybacks basically are people cleaning out their closets of guns they don't want. It turns out they don't reach the crime guns on the street. Mm-hmm. This was aimed directly at the illicit markets, like illicit drug markets, that were selling guns to people who were already not legally entitled to have them. Those are very dangerous guns. And we figured out how to do it. We made a lot of headway with law enforcement. They started shutting these gun markets down. And when the Bush administration came in, the NRA shut the whole program down.
Another listener, Mary, writes, I read about this program in Newsweek. It's amazing. What are the prospects for these cities to stick to the model? It seems to me that this needs to be a whole paradigm shift or a substantial shift in the whole way of doing things.
What your listener said.
You agree.
That's what we're working on. And it's happening. We have a long record of cities picking this up, kind of not taking it all that seriously, getting huge results out of it, and as the listener correctly focuses on, not sustaining it. That's changing. And we're seeing cities now that look at this record, they get it, they take it very seriously, and they're doing the common sense work they need to do to make it standard practice.
And here's another listener says, I'm recently admitted lawyer in Missouri who wants to work on the gang and prison problems in the St. Louis area. Two questions. One, if someone wants to work within their local system using your methodologies, how can they start? And two, I'm a little skeptical that your program requires resources that some cities don't have. In East St. Louis, across the river, they have two police detectives to work homicide cases, and in many cases, homicide investigations can't even be initiated. In this economic climate, is it viable that every city can use your plan when police resources are so thin?
So on the first question, I'm easy to track down. Track me down. There's stuff going on in St. Louis that I can try to introduce you to. And more broadly, so there's a threshold of not just resources, but kind of organizational competence below which you can't do anything. Right? So you need a certain basic level of functioning in order to do this kind of work or any kind of work. What you find in practice is that law enforcement and other agencies, and again, this is not just about or even primarily about the cops, but they look at this, if they're honest, they say the following thing. We've been putting an enormous amount of energy into this by doing things that we know don't work. And when resources are tight, we're going to make the hard choices. We're going to stop investing in things that don't work, and we're going to move those assets over into something that does.
We're talking again with David Kennedy. His new book is Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. David writes, Mr. Kennedy, what are Oakland and Richmond doing wrong?
So there's a team operating out of Oakland. They're sited at the Public Health Institute, and they have a moderate but crucial amount of backing from the state of California and from foundations. And they are working not only with Oakland and Richmond, but a number of other cities around the state to help them do this work. So it's underway.
Let's go to more of your calls and welcome Dana from Vallejo. Good morning, Dana. Talk about cities that don't have police anymore. Boy, you've got up there.
Speaking of which, I was held up at gunpoint on the 4th of July, 9 a.m., by three gang members right outside the door of my apartment. But my question is this, my statement in question is this. Whatever happened to constables on patrol, cops, real cops, street cops that walk beats or bicycles, that you know them in the neighborhood, that you're not afraid as a citizen to go up and talk to them and share information? The last time I tried to talk to a police officer, they snubbed me. And what I felt when I was held up at gunpoint, when the police came out, they were unsympathetic, they were unempathetic. And I think we need more cops on bicycles and more cops on street beats, patrolling neighborhoods, getting to know the community and letting the community know it's okay to call us and tell us when you feel that you've seen some gang activity. I will take my answer off the air, and thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. David Kennedy.
Thank you. So first of all, what happened to you is appalling, and I'm sorry. And you're being treated that way by law enforcement is appalling. And because I'm connected to that world, I'm sorry for that too. So there's a long, long history of why American police departments function the way they do now. But the short version is about 60 years ago, they went through a transformation that got them out of communities in the way that you talk about, and into cars and on the radio. And the work that I'm part of began in the mid-1980s with the profession itself realizing that in many ways that had been a terrible, terrible mistake. And we're still dealing with that. As far as these problems we're talking about, we need rapid, powerful, effective responses. And as a lot of departments still are trying to undo the damage of that change and the way they isolated themselves from communities, and they'll continue to do that work, that's a long, painful process. In the meantime, we need to do some things that will keep you from getting stuck up outside your door. And actually, we know how to do that now.
What about drug decriminalization? Where do you stand on that?
I ignore it.
Plain spoken?
It's not going to happen.
Well, here's Antoine, who says, I was driving to see my grandmother in the hilltop area of Richmond, and I was pulled over at night. There was another officer who showed up on the scene, and I was pulled out of the car. The cop asked me if he had arrested me before. He had not called in my information, and this has happened to me in Castro Valley and Dublin, also where I live. I don't think that the police hate those in the streets. I think that time you are in situations where you have no experience, I think that's the case for a lot of police. They come from different walks of life. They're thrown into these neighborhoods that they speak of but don't know of.
And that is the gospel.
You don't buy the gospel?
Oh, no, I do buy it. I think he's absolutely, absolutely right. And I've had my own journey on this, so I'm ashamed of myself a lot. And one of the things I'm ashamed of is how long it took me to see not only what the caller is talking about, but just how awful it is and how toxic it is and how it plays out in all the ways that we're talking about, in the way it drives wedges between law enforcement and the community. And look, if you get a chance to look at the book, I am enormously outspoken about this. And I say out loud what people are usually unwilling to say, which is that a lot of what cops do on the street is illegal. It's not just wrong. It's not just outrageous. It's not just mistaken. It's illegal. And I know why they do it. And they don't do it because they're malicious, horrible people. They do it mostly because they're scared and they don't know what they're dealing with. And they are genuinely trying to protect the community. And they think that it's okay to do it in the way that they're doing it. It's not okay. It causes horrible problems. And it's part of the reason, as the previous caller said, why the community didn't want to talk to the cops.
And we're going to talk to more of our listeners. We'll hear next from you, Denise. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering, with this new law that requires the quote-unquote nonviolent offenders to be housed in the county jails, is this an opportune time for Mr. Kelly's model to be implemented, especially since a lot of the nonviolent criminals are drug-related crimes?
It's Mr. Kennedy, Denise, but thank you for that question. David Kennedy?
I think it is, and let me take a step back from the particulars of what's going on with corrections in California. And what's going on with corrections in California is going on partly because we simply cannot pay these bills anymore, because the way we've been addressing this problem in California is an extreme example of it, but it's typical. We cannot lock everybody up.
We are going to talk about realignment tomorrow, in fact. We've got 30,000 people who are going out.
We cannot protect these communities by locking all of their men up. You know, we can't do it. And in a strange way, the fiscal crisis is bringing attention to bear on the prison bills. And I cannot tell you how offended I am by this, that finally white folks are saying there are too many people in prison, not because there are too many people in prison, but because they don't want to pay the bills anymore. And if they still had money, they'd be perfectly happy to lock everybody up. But it is what it is. It's bringing the issue to the surface again. And law enforcement's been saying for years, we can't arrest our way out of this. They mean it. They know that. And in a funny way, the fiscal crisis is making the work that I've been part of more appealing to people, because it's making them honest. It's making them look at where their money's actually going. They kind of know that a lot of this money they're spending isn't producing anything. They've been able to ignore that because the money's been out there, but it's not out there anymore. And it's making these alternatives suddenly a lot more appealing to people.
I mentioned before the interrupters, they're working on the ceasefire in Chicago. Is this sort of a spinoff inspired by your work? Or?
So the story there is that my group in Boston actually helped what became Chicago Ceasefire get going right at the very beginning. We didn't play a very big role, but they came to Boston. We went to Chicago. And in the end, Chicago Ceasefire ran with only the street outreach component of what was the bigger Boston partnership. And they also adopted the Boston name. So they call themselves Ceasefire. It's been very, very confusing to everybody. They are not doing what I've been talking about. They're doing something different.
What about citizen policing? Where does that fit in, or does it?
So what do we mean by that?
Well, in Oakland, for example, they experimented a while back under Elihu Harris of getting citizens involved in police work, reporting incidents, acting, as not only good citizens, but also acting in the interest of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. So I have a really stupid metric for all this stuff, and it's just to ask. So in these communities that I'm committed to that are dealing with the problems we're talking about, has it worked? And the answer for those issues in those places is no, it hasn't. Doesn't mean it's not a good idea. It may have been helpful in all kinds of other ways, but did it crack this one? No.
We go to more of your calls. We'll go to Oakland. Mary, join us. You're on.
Oh, hi. Yes. I want to commend you, David, for your optimism and your perseverance, but just as someone who is, liberal and has been concerned about race, as a Jew or whatever, I frankly have given up in some ways on this community because it appears that there's just not movement on it, as you say with your statistics. I mean, we have about 60-70% of black households where the father is not present. We have a 50% dropout rate from school, there seems to be a sort of anti-education sentiment within that community in terms of the black, you know, urban underclass. I remember a story in Richmond a few years ago where a great kid was going to get a football scholarship. You know, they killed him. I mean, even the ones that do well within their community, they'll take them out. And I can't seem to keep up my optimism. You know, we have other immigrant communities that, you know, are using education, like the Chinese or, you know, groups like this. And it seems to me the black community has a bad attitude, is how I feel now. And I, you know, look at Chicago, look at our inner cities. I mean, I think it's fantastic that you have remained caring and optimistic. I'd like to know why you are not a black man. I mean, it's great that you are who you are. And, you know, you see guys like P. Diddy just, you know, just so materialistic and crass. I don't think he's a good example for that community. But anyway, it's just I have sort of given up, and I'm sad for it.
Mary, I'd like to get David Kennedy's response as we come to the end of this program.
You're not actually an undercover narcotics cop, are you? Because
the real question is, how do you keep your optimism? How do you keep your attitude?
This is a kind of delightful moment, because this is what we've just heard is exactly the kind of thing that I hear every day from the cops that I'm trying to convince that they're wrong, and they are wrong. And if you're close enough to the community, right, you can't be at a distance and watch this stuff and understand it. You really have to be close to it. And if you're close to it, you realize that her conclusions are mistaken and that the community is much more complicated than we think it is. It's not lost. It is full of aspiration. And if we'd spent hundreds of years doing to other communities what we've done to the black community, they'd be in trouble too.
Well, I don't know if Mary's undercover or not, but it's certainly been a pleasure having you on. David Kennedy, again, we'll be at Stanford Law School this evening, 5:30 to 7, with the Chief of Police of East Palo Alto. Thank you so much. Another hour forum on the way. Thank you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.